Today we're finishing up what seems like it's probably to you a long series called Foundations. And do if you've been here kind of over the last few weeks and been a part of that, due to the nature of kind of the thinking nature of it, I came across this I thought some of you might appreciate. It started out innocently enough. I begin to think at parties now and then to loosen up. Inevitably, though, one thought led to another, and soon I was more than just a social thinker. I began to think alone, to relax, I told myself, but I knew it wasn't true. Thinking became more and more important to me, and finally, I was thinking all the time. I began to think on the job. Now, I knew that thinking and employment don't mix, but I couldn't stop myself. I began to avoid friends at lunchtime so I could read Chesterton and Thoreau. I would return to the office dazed and confused and asking, what is it exactly we're doing here anyway? Things weren't going so great at home either. One evening, I turned off the phone or the TV and asked my wife about the meaning of life. She spent that night at her mother's. I soon had a reputation as a heavy thinker. One day, the boss called me in. He said, Skippy, I like you, and it hurts me to say this to you, but your thinking has become a real problem. If you don't stop thinking at work, you'll have to find another job. Well, this gave me a lot to think about. I came home early after my conversation with the boss. Honey, I confessed, I've been thinking. I know you've been thinking, she said, and I want a divorce. But honey, surely it's not that serious. Oh, it is serious, she said, her lower lip a quiver. You think as much as college professors, and college professors don't make any money, so if you keep thinking, we won't have any money. That's a faulty syllogism, I said impatiently as she began to cry. I'd had enough. I'm going to the library, I snarled as I stomped out the door. I headed for the library in the mood for some Nietzsche and NPR on the radio. I roared into the parking lot and ran up to the big glass doors. But they didn't open. The library was closed. To this day, I believe that a higher power was looking out for me that night. As I sank to the ground, clawing at the unfeeling glass, a poster caught my eye. Friend, it said, is heavy thinking ruining your life? You probably recognize that line. It comes from the standard Thinkers Anonymous poster. Which is why I am what I am today, a recovering thinker. I never missed a TA meeting. At each meeting, we watch a non-educational video. Last week, it was Dancing with the Stars. Then we share experiences about how we avoided thinking since the last meeting. I still have my job, and things are a lot better at home. Life just seemed easier somehow once I stopped thinking. I don't know about you, but we've been kind of doing some kind of brain-intensive stuff over the last few weeks. We started off with kind of the philosophical, you know, nature of truth, and we talked about that, and we talked about this whole idea of worldviews and kind of some of the heavy questions that, you know, we have to ask about life. You know, where do we come from, and what went wrong with the world, and how do we fix it? And because of that, some of you, you know, may think that I am a problem thinker, all right? But I think, though, that as Christians, we should be engaging in kind of a higher level thinking and doing it more often. Because what was it Jesus said? We're going to look at this a little bit later. But Jesus said one of the primary commandments that we are to follow is to love God with all of our mind. Our heart, yes, but our mind as well. We're supposed to follow God with all of our mind. And so, therefore, as we're cultivating a biblical worldview, as we're trying to develop a Christian mind, as we're trying to learn what it means to build all of our thinking and base it on the Bible in every area of our life, we need to constantly ask ourselves, no matter what the topic is, what does the Bible have to say about that topic, and then build our thinking from there. So whether the topic is, you know, cultural or family or work or political or entertainment, you know, whenever you're watching the most recent episode of whatever show it is that you watch, you need to be asking yourself, what view of life are they selling? And as a Christian, should I be buying whatever view of life that they're selling? Because trust me when I tell you that everything that you see is selling some view of the way life is and the way it should be. Well, since we've been kind of dealing with some of these heavy topics over the last few weeks, I thought we would end our series on a little lighter note this week with the kind of the fourth question that all worldviews need to answer. And that's just simply the meaning of life. So today we're going to look at that light topic. What is the meaning or the purpose of life? Now, people have asked that question as long as there's been life, and people have come up with all kinds of different answers to the question. It was Mark Twain who said, the two most important days in your life are the day you were born and the day you find out why. Now, I'm just telling you this morning, you are in luck. Whether you are a regular member, you're here all the time, or whether you just kind of wandered in, this is your first time checking it out, you couldn't have picked a better day to be here, because I don't know when your birthday is, but you're in luck. This could be the second most important day of your life, because we're going to jump into this topic of what is the meaning and the purpose of life. Now, at first glance, that question seems like, again, another really high, difficult, philosophical question that makes your eyes glaze over. But really, what I hope that we'll see is that it's really not that hard of a question. In fact, as I've said all throughout this series, that what we believe about God will actually lead us to the answer to those questions. What we believe about God will determine our worldview, and then our worldview will help us answer those questions of life. Where do we come from? What's the meaning and purpose of life as well? Now, you may or may not know it, but there's actually a whole book in the Bible that's devoted to this topic. It's the book of Ecclesiastes, and its author, Solomon, who was King David's son. You remember King David, David and Goliath. You remember him? Well, this is his son, Solomon. Solomon was king of Israel about 1,000 years before Jesus came, and he actually dedicated a certain portion of his life to this question: what is the meaning and the purpose of life? Now, due to his position as king, he had both the time and the resources to kind of explore this pretty fully, and he tried all the stuff that you've either tried or wanted to, right? And he came up with some conclusions. But before we look at what he said, I just kind of want to bring to your mind that really, when we think about this whole idea of what is the meaning or the purpose of life, there's really only four broad options, four big categories that it could fall under. The first one is that there is no cosmic meaning. Right? There is no purpose, right? There's no higher overarching story. There's no meta-narrative. There's no ultimate purpose, no big picture in life. And a lot of people live their life that way. There's no cosmic meaning. A second option would be, well, there's no cosmic meaning, but perhaps I could forge some meaning on my own. I could come up with some meaning to make this life worthwhile. This is summed up in the 20th century French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. He said, "Man can will nothing unless he has first understood that he must count just on himself, that he is alone, abandoned on earth, in the midst of his infinite responsibilities, without help, with no other aims than those he sets himself, with no other destiny than the one he forges for himself on this earth." In other words, there is no overarching purpose. There's no grand narrative. But perhaps, if you try, you can come up with something to scratch out some significance in this life. That's not a very hopeful way to live, but again, a lot of people would live that way. A third option is that life might have a cosmic meaning, but it's too big or confusing for us mere mortals to understand, right? That there might be some God out there somewhere, and there might be some big purpose, but we're just not smart enough to figure it out. Okay, a lot of people think in terms of that. Or a fourth option is that, no, there is a purpose out there, and in fact, if you try hard enough and if you apply yourself, you can find what that purpose is. Again, all of those depend on your view of God, right? Those first two, there is no meaning, or there is no meaning, but you can try to come up with meaning of your own. That would be kind of a non-God, an atheistic approach. If there is no God, then there's no purpose. The last two kind of, again, depends on your view of God. The third one is, yeah, there might be a God, but he's kind of a distant, far away God that doesn't really have anything to do with my life. And the fourth one says, no, maybe there is a God, and he's made it possible for us to know what the meaning and purpose of our life happens to be. Well, let's take a look and see what Solomon found as he wrote it down for us in the book of Ecclesiastes. We're going to start right at the very beginning, Ecclesiastes chapter 1. The first 9 verses will kind of just set us up for where we're going to see what else he came up with. This is what he said in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. "The words of the teacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless." Well, don't hold back, Solomon. Tell us what you're really thinking there, all right? Pretty cheerful start there. "What does a man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the north and then turns to the south. Round and round it goes. Where it stops, nobody knows." Oh, wait, that's not in there. That's the Living Bible translation. But that's kind of the idea, right? Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. "All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams came from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Right? So Solomon actually starts out where a lot of people today end up, which is unfortunate because this is where, just where Solomon ended up. But Solomon's basically saying that apart from God, if we're just in Solomon's vernacular looking under the sun, just looking from a human perspective, there is no purpose. There is no meaning in life. And actually, if you are coming at things from a non-God perspective, from an atheistic perspective, that's actually the most logical conclusion to come to. Because if there is no God, if our origin, if we just happen to be here, was random and accidental and meaningless, then our life and our death would also be random and purposeless. That just makes sense. That's logical to think. Again, apart from God, there's really only two logical conclusions. The overarching conclusion is there's no purpose, so then I'll make my own purpose of just survival. If you're taking notes, that's kind of the first one. One thing, apart from God, is just sheer survival. Well-known atheist Richard Dawkins said this, "We are survival machines, robot vehicles blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes." And if that were, if there were no God, then that would absolutely be true. If evolution were true and we're just here to survive and to pass on our genes to the next generation, then survival would be the utmost goal in life. Atheism says there is no purpose, but as C.S. Lewis said, atheism turns out to be too simple. Because if the whole universe has no meaning, we should never have found out that it has no meaning. And think about what he's saying. If there was no God, if there was no purpose, if our brains are just a collection of random accidental chemicals, then there would be no reason for us to even consider the question of purpose for life. Take a look at this picture. If indeed we climbed out of the slime, you know, millions of years ago and just eat and survive and reproduce and eat, survive, reproduce, eat, survive, reproduce, eat, survive, reproduce. Oh, I wonder why we're here. What's the meaning of all this? It doesn't make any sense. If that was how things went, that's all we would continue to think about is surviving. But the fact that we ask the question about meaning suggests that there is an answer to be found. But even though that kind of a response, that survival is all there is to things, is logical for an atheist or someone that doesn't really believe in God, some of us that wouldn't consider ourselves atheists, we still kind of default into that position sometimes. And here's what I mean. I mean, life is just hard sometimes, isn't it? I mean, sometimes it seems like, and it's easy for us to start thinking that really survival is, I mean, you're just trying to get to the next day, right? And it's Monday, it's, you know, this is Sunday, and we can take a break, but man, tomorrow is Monday again, and then, you know, just surviving, trying to get from one day to the next. Life is sometimes hard with all of the circumstances that come crashing down on us sometimes. Sometimes we feel like life is just hard, and the only goal is just to survive to the next day. Sometimes we feel like these guys, right? You feel like it's a dog-eat-dog world, and you've done been et, right? It's like you are here. It's just sometimes it feels like that, that life is hard, and the goal just is to survive. But and for many people, that's the only goal and meaning that they have in life. But as I think you'll agree, even if you feel like that's where you're at, that's not a very life-giving, joy-producing reason to live, is it? But that's where many people today in our world, and maybe you this morning, find ourselves. The good news is, stay with us, because Solomon's not done. This is just where he's starting. This is not where he's finishing up. He said one would be just simple survival. A second option for the purpose of life, and it's probably the most common one, the most popular one today, is that, yeah, there is no cosmic purpose. There is no overarching picture, but maybe I'll try to form some meaning for myself, and the meaning that most people try to find is just simple happiness, right? To just happiness. 2,400 years ago, Aristotle said, "Happiness is the meaning and the purpose of life, the whole aim and end of human existence." All right? He was a smart guy. 2,400 years ago, that's what he came up with. Not long ago, the Dalai Lama said this, "One great question underlies our experience, whether we think about it consciously or not. That is, what is the purpose of life? I believe," he said, "that the purpose of life is to be happy." It's a very common theme. Or as the great theologian Anonymous put it recently on a chat board online, the purpose of life is to be happy, healthy, and hungover. Order optional. Right? And maybe you can identify with that. Just, is there some purpose? I just got to try to find meaning, try to be happy any way that I can. It's a very widespread idea. Not long ago, or actually a few years ago, I read about an education professor at a major university who told his class, quote, "More important than content or thinking are the students' feelings. You are not there to feed them information, but to be sensitive to their need for positive reinforcement for self-esteem." Think about that. There is someone teaching future teachers that, hey, it's not important what you teach the kids. It's important how you make them feel, because it's all about being happy, which explains, in large part, I think, why our test scores continue going down, but we feel better about it. All right? Our kids do worse than ever, but they're okay with that, because why? Because the goal is happiness. And while it's easy to kind of point at those people out there and say, yeah, they shouldn't do things like that, sometimes it's closer to home. Think about this. If you were to ask the question to parents, what do you want most for your kids? If we would ask that, you know, 50 or 60 years ago, for some of you who were little kids 50 or 60 years ago, if you ask your parents, they would have said, I want my kids to be good. And what they meant was they wanted them to be honorable, God-fearing kids, right? They wanted to raise good kids. That's, I think, what the majority of people would have said then. Then 20 or 30 years ago, you know, when I'm growing up, if you'd have asked the majority of parents what they wanted for their kids, what might they have said? I think the majority would have said, I want my kids to be successful. And I want them to have, you know, a better job than I did, or have more things than I had, you know, the things that I never got to experience. I want my kids to be successful. But you know, today, I think if we ask parents, a majority of parents, what do you want most for your kids? I think the majority of parents today would say, I just want my kids to be happy. That's what we'd say, isn't it? Because that's just how much things have changed. And it subtly kind of horned its way in that is the ultimate meaning and purpose of life. I just want to be happy. I want my kids to be happy. Of course, there are all kinds of things that people use to try to make themselves happy. The problem is, happy is a moving target, isn't it? And it's hard to kind of fix on, because once you get something that makes you happy, it doesn't make you happy for very long. And sometimes it makes you feel worse after it's done making you feel happy. And so many of us have tried things that would make us happy, like Solomon did, only to end up disappointed and empty inside in the end. Let's take a look and see what Solomon said about some of those things. He tried many things to make him happy and to try to find meaning and purpose, again, under the sun, apart from God. One of the first things he tried was pleasure. In Ecclesiastes chapter 2, he said this, "I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. So I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. My mind was still guiding me with wisdom, but I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives." Check out this, verse 10. "I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure." Some of you think that sounds pretty good. He was the king. He had incredible resources. He could make this happen. "I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure." So you would think if you had that kind of capability, that surely you could find some meaning. Solomon tried wine, women, and song. He tried sex, drugs, rock and roll. You name it, he did it. Okay, he was thinking, he tried it all. What did he find? What was his conclusion? Chapter 2, verse 1, he says, "But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is madness. And what does pleasure accomplish?" His search for a meaning through pleasure left him empty and hollow inside. And some of you know that feeling, right? Trying to be happy through pleasure and doing things what feels good, but then only ending up empty and hollow inside. Some of you call that college, okay? You understand that idea of trying to find pleasure and try to find meaning through pleasure, but in the end, there's not enough sex, or there's not enough beer, or there's not enough drugs, there's not enough parties, there's not enough whatever it is that you tried to make you to make that emptiness go away. And that's exactly what Solomon found. He also tried education. Look at Ecclesiastes 1:13. He says, "I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven." All right, he was going to be wise. He was going to get smart. All right, and the Bible actually says that he was the wisest man that ever lived, except for Jesus when he was on the earth. So he was a smart guy. Here's what he said. "I said to myself, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ever ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much wisdom and knowledge. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much, what? Sorrow. And the more knowledge, the more what? Grief. Solomon understood that there was such a thing as blissful ignorance, right? Because he understood that the more you knew, the more grief and the more pain and the more sorrow came with that. The more you understood how things really were in the world, the more sorrow and grief came along with that. And he said that it's okay to know stuff and to be wise, but it's not a great thing to hang as your purpose and your meaning for life. He also tried wealth and material abundance. Chapter 2, verse 7 and 8. He says, he owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. The Bible says that Solomon was the richest guy that ever lived as well. He says, I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasures of kings and provinces. He tried incredible riches. He says, surely I can find some purpose and some meaning if I just have all the stuff that I want. His conclusion in chapter 5, verses 10 through 15 says this, whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. This too is meaningless. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owners except for to feast their eyes on them for a little while? The sleep of the laborer is sweet, whether they eat little or much. But as for the rich, their abundance permits them no sleep. He says, I have seen a grievous evil under the sun. Wealth hoarded to the harm of its owners. You ever seen that? Or wealth lost through some misfortune. You ever seen that? So that when they have children, there is nothing left for them to inherit. Everyone comes naked from their mother's womb, and as everyone comes, so they depart. They take nothing with them. They take what? Nothing with them through their toil that they can carry in their hands. I mean, this could have been written yesterday, right? I mean, the Bible is so relevant to our lives. You ought to read it sometime. I mean, there's some really cool stuff in there, right? The Bible is just so relevant. He said, I'll try pleasure. No, that's not it. I'll try education. No, that's not it. I'll try wealth. No, that's not it. So he poured himself into his work. Chapter 2, verse 4, he says he undertook great projects. And like many people today, he thought, maybe I can find some meaning or purpose in my work. I'm going to pour myself into my work or pour myself into my hobby. I'm going to find some meaning and purpose that way. What was his conclusion? This too is meaningless, he said. He said, somebody's going to come after me and they're going to get whatever it is I've worked for, whatever I've built. And in Solomon's own words, he says, who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish? He said, I can work all my life and build this incredible thing, but who knows, the guy that's going to inherit the company is going to be an idiot, right? He's going to tear up everything that I took so much time to build up. And he says, work is a great thing, but it's not a great thing to make as the center and the meaning and find purpose in your life. What other things do people try? Well, some people today try, power or positions of authority. They think they get to a certain level and have enough people answering to them, and that'll find meaning and purpose. Of course, Solomon was actually king, so that was pretty much as high as you could go. So he didn't have to really experiment with that. He knew what that was, and he said that wasn't it. Some people try religion, trying to be good to find meaning and purpose that way. In fact, a recent book that studied the spiritual life of teenagers, but I think it probably applies to more than just teenagers, this was their conclusion. They said, instead of learning the basic tenets of their religion, many teens are simply absorbing a belief that if you try to be good all the time, you'll be happy. And being happy is what life is all about. See, I think that's why so many people today think, well, all religions are the same. They just teach you how to be good. And being good makes you happy. And being happy is the point. So it doesn't matter what religion you choose. Just choose whichever one makes you happy, because, again, being happy is the whole point. Other people try, the approval of others. They might think not to try to make themselves happy, but they dedicate their life and they try to just make everybody else happy. And that's their kind of purpose of life. We could go on and on, right, of all the different things that people tried, all the things that not people, but that we have tried, right? Solomon wrote a book. We could write a book, couldn't we? And you could add a chapter to the book, right, of all the things that we've tried to find purpose and meaning in our life and that didn't work, right? Many of the same things that Solomon tried. And there's other things throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. You should check it out. But we've tried some of those things. We've tried money and wealth and pleasure and work and relationships and all kinds of different things. And we come to the same conclusion, and if you haven't, you will, that Solomon came to, said these are all just meaningless. They're not worth building your life around. Well, if that's the case, what was Solomon's conclusion? Where did he come to at the end? Was it just that hopeless, as hopeless as he started with meaningless, meaningless, everything's meaningless? Or did he come to a different conclusion? His conclusion is found in, right at the end of the book of Ecclesiastes in chapter 12, verses 13 and 14. This is what he writes. He says, now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. All right. I've spent lots of years trying everything. Okay. I'm the king. I've tried it all. Here's what I've come up with. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. Solomon says, I've tried it all, and here's my conclusion. Fear God and keep his commandments. That's the whole duty of man. Fear God, keep his commandments. I think it's interesting that he didn't say, fear God, keep his commandments. These are the duties of man. Right? Because to me, it sounds like two different things. But to Solomon, it was actually one and the same thing. He said, fear God, keep his commandments. It's the same thing. This is the one single duty of man. And the reason it doesn't make sense to us like it did to Solomon is because I don't think we understand very well this idea of the fear of God, what it means to fear God. In fact, just saying fear God, some of us are like, wait a minute, fear God? I thought we were supposed to like love God. What's this fear God thing? Well, the biblical concept of fearing God kind of wraps up a whole bunch of different things all at once. And mostly the idea is to understand who God is, right? Whenever you read fear God in the Bible, it means to understand who he is, to try to recognize, realize who God actually is, and then always in comparison with who we are. To recognize the awesomeness, the greatness, the incredible power and awesome nature of who God is. Okay? And it kind of wraps up lots of different things. It includes, you know, acknowledge him as our creator. We talked about that several weeks ago. Right? It starts there. To acknowledge him as our creator. We've got to revere him as our sustainer, that he kind of keeps everything going. We love him as our father. There's the relational peace. We worship him as the Savior. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. We obey him as Lord. We, yes, fear him as judge, because as Solomon says, he will judge every hidden act, whether good or evil. Solomon said, you want some purpose in your life? Let me tell you, I've tried it all. Fear God. Understand who God is. Recognize who God is. And from Solomon's perspective, once we recognize who God is, it just goes hand in hand that of course then we would obey his commandments. Because if you understand who God is and you understand who you are, the only logical conclusion is to do what he has said. Solomon said, fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. Of course, when Solomon wrote that, there were lots of different commandments, all right? Not just the big 10 that we think about, you know, the 10 commandments. There were hundreds, literally hundreds of commands throughout the Old Testament. So when Jesus came on the scene, he actually broke it down for us, simplified it a little bit, and we're going to kind of hang out for the last few minutes on what Jesus said and kind of how he helped us understand what Solomon was writing about. Jesus said this in Matthew chapter 22. It's also found in Mark 12. Teacher, somebody came and asked Jesus what the most important commandment was. Teacher, which is the greatest commandment of the law? He was asked. And Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your, what? Mind. That's right. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. Jesus says, the highest purpose for your life. He's echoing exactly what Solomon said. He said, the highest purpose for your life is that you love God with everything that you've got. Solomon said it this way, to fear God, to understand who God is. Jesus said, once you understand who God is, the proper response, the only thing you can do is to love God with everything that you've got. Jesus said, our primary purpose, your primary purpose, the highest goal that God has for your life is to have a relationship with him. To have communion with him, to have fellowship with him, to be in a relationship with him, to love him with everything that you've got, because God has loved you with everything that he's got. That is the relationship that God wants for you. And if you came here this morning having no clue what the meaning and the purpose of your life, hear me, actually hear Jesus say, the highest purpose for your life actually doesn't have as much to do with you as it does with him. The highest purpose of your life is to have a relationship with God. Jesus said to love God with everything you've got And if you're looking for meaning and purpose, you've got to start there. Because Jesus said that is the biggest, highest purpose for your life. But he didn't stop there. He said the second is like to it. Love people. If you're filling out your blank, you probably already figured that one out. The first purpose for your life is to love God. The second is to love people. Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself. This kind of just, again, flows. If we love God with everything we've got, then we will understand His love for people. If, again, our worldview comes into play, if we realize and understand that God created everyone in His image, we'll believe, like C.S. Lewis, that there are no ordinary people, that we've never met a mere mortal, that every single human being we ever lock eyes with has an eternal spirit and an eternal spark. They are made in the image of God. And so if we truly believe that, then it only makes sense because of our love from God, then we let His love for other people spill out and we will love other people as well. Now, how do we love other people? Well, it could be just as simple as the golden rule, right? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That makes sense. But actually the highest way, the biggest way, the most important way that you could ever love someone, again, it stems right out of the worldview thinking that we've been talking about the last few weeks. The biggest way that you can love someone is to tell them about Jesus. Think about this. If you agree, if you believe, like we talked about the last 2 weeks, that the biggest problem in the world and the biggest problem with every individual person, with me and with you and with every other person, if the biggest problem is our sin, and the reason it's our biggest problem is because it destroys our relationship with God. And remember, our relationship with God is the highest meaning for our life. Okay, if we truly believe that, and we understand that, as we learned last week, that Jesus, or 2 weeks ago, that Jesus is the way back to the Father, that He is the Savior, He fixes that sin problem that we couldn't do anything about. If we truly believe all that, then it only makes sense for us to realize that the greatest way we can love other people is by sharing Christ with them, to share who Jesus is and how He can restore our relationship with the Father. Okay, so that is the primary and greatest way that we can love other people. But that's not the only way we can demonstrate our love for others. I think there's a second significant way that we can honor God and love God and also show our love for people. And that's your third thing on your blank, is that's just to make things better. All right? To make things better. Love God, love people, make things better. Now, I don't have a specific verse for this one because the theme is just found all throughout Scripture. Starting in Genesis chapter 1, where God tells Adam and Eve, kind of gives them a cultural commission to fill the earth and multiply and bring everything under the dominion and authority of God, to where Jesus said His very first public sermon, He told His followers to be salt and light. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world, He said, and we're supposed to make things better. The very next chapter, Matthew chapter 6, He's teaching us how to pray. And He said, pray this way. Pray, Your kingdom come, Your will be done on earth as it is where? In heaven. That we, as His followers, are to try to make this earth as much like heaven as possible. That doesn't mean we're trying to establish a theocracy here in America or anything like that. It's just acknowledging the idea that we believe God's way is the best way. Right? We believe that God, if things work better if we do it the way God intended it to be done. And so we try to bring God's truth to bear on every facet of our life, whether it's our family life, the educational system, the political system, your workplace, the culture at large, everything. We believe that God's way is the best way to do it, and so we try to implement God's principles as best we can in that aspect of the world to try to make things better. Because here's what we believe. I mean, don't we, as Christians, we believe that God's ways are the best ways, right? We believe that that's true whether you believe it or not, right? It doesn't matter if someone believes in God, God's ways still work best for that person. And so the way to love other people is to try to help things on earth be more like God said they should be. And that actually will benefit everyone. It's a great way to show our love for other people. Ron and I had the opportunity this week to go see the movie The Dropbox. I don't know if you heard about it. If you were one of the 70 that were here last Sunday, in amidst all the snow, we showed a little trailer for it. But it was a great movie, and maybe we'll show it here sometime, of minister, Pastor Lee, over in Seoul, South Korea, whose heart was broken because of all the abandoned babies that he saw throughout the city of Seoul, Korea. And so he created this little baby box, and there's been other people that have tried to do that in other different places. But in the side of his house, he built this little box that was heated, and so that mothers could bring their unwanted children, their unwanted babies, and put them in this box, and so that they could save the life of the babies. Now, he's been doing that for over 5 years, and hundreds of children have been saved because he loved God and he loved people enough to say, hey, I'm going to make a difference. I'm going to make things better in this area. So the question that I have for you is, what stirs you? Where do you look at the world and say, that's broken. That shouldn't be that way. That being that way, it hurts God. It goes against God's principles and it hurts other people. And I could do something about that. What is it that stirs you? Where has God put you? Where has he, what field of influence do you have that you could make things better, that you could bring God's truth to bear in that situation? Abraham Kuyper, the Dutch politician and philosopher and theologian, and those three don't go together very often, but they did for him. He said this, and this is an incredible quote: "There is not one square inch of the whole human, or the whole domain of human existence, as to which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry out, 'Mine.' And as he cries out, 'Mine,' the church cries out, 'His.'" See, as I've said every week, our worldview and how we live our life has everything to do with what we believe about God. Right? If we truly believe in an all-powerful creator God, then we believe that there's not one square inch of everything out there that God doesn't say, "That's mine, and I want it to be good." And if we believe that as his people, as his followers, then is part of our purpose in life to try to make things better, to bring things in line with the way God would have them to be, to help restore things to how he intended them to be. You want some meaning? You're looking for purpose in your life this morning? The reality is God doesn't care as much. You know, often we ask that question like when we're about to change jobs, or, you know, we're trying to think about if we're going to buy a house, or you know, do some major life change. We ask, you know, God, what's the meaning? You know, what's your will for my life? The reality is, I think God is not so concerned with where you work, but how you work there. He's not so concerned with where you live, but how you live there. God's ultimate purpose for you is that you love him with everything that you've got, that you build that relationship with him, and he made a way through Jesus Christ to make that possible for us to have that relationship with him. It's your highest goal. No matter what you do, no matter where you work, your highest goal is to have a relationship and to love God with everything you've got. And then to let that kind of love bleed over and spill out onto all the people around you as we try to make this world a better place. You want some meaning and purpose? Our bottom line this morning, just to repeat that, is the purpose that God has for you is this: to love him with everything you've got, to love people because they're made in his image and he loves them and he died for them just like he did for you, and to make things better, to do everything that we can to bring this world into line with the world that's to come.